I know there are some fans in here of the satirical news organization, the Babylon Bee. I rarely read the articles personally, but the headlines are great. There was one early this week. Lee, you reminded me of it just a little while ago in your communion presentation, but it went something like this: Jesus bummed because he was born on December 25, and now his birthday will be overshadowed every year by Christmas. So I thought that was pretty clever, and I imagine that article had a lot to say about consumerism. That's my best guess. Every once in a while, at the beginning of a sermon, now Paul Ellison likes to give me a hard time that I do this because my sermon's too short, so I'm just wasting some time. But what I'll do is I'll just ask folks to stand. Don't do this yet, by the way. There are some specific instructions. I'll ask if everyone who's able would stand and then just move around and greet people. This morning, we're going to do something similar, but not exactly like that. In just a moment, if you're able, I'm going to ask you to stand quietly. Just don't speak a word, but just stand quietly, look around. You'll make eye contact with people. If you want to nod your head and smile, that's great, but just stand and look at the people around you. And while we're doing this, let me say a few things. You know, there's a good chance that you're looking at somebody who's a lot like you. The majority of us in this room are what we would call WASPs, right? White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Our ancestors came from Europe somewhere. But that's not all of us. We have folks of Hispanic origin, folks whose heritage is Mexico, whose heritage is Ecuador, whose heritage is other Latin American places. We have people whose heritage is African American, is Filipino, and that's just ethnicity. But you also might be looking at somebody who grew up very differently than you or I did. You might be looking at somebody who has a different belief system, and if we think that everybody in this room right now believes the same thing, we're pretty naive, because there's a lot of different sets of beliefs in here. There's about 100%, you can sit now, thank you. There's about 100% chance, by the way, that as you looked around, you were looking at somebody really strange. And there's probably about 100% chance that at least one person, when they looked at you, was thinking the same thing. Because we all have within us some measure of strangeness. Some of us may hide it better than others. Some of us may wear it as a banner of pride everywhere we go, but we're all strange. We're all different. Here's the thing about that, is that can keep us from interacting with somebody, can it not? Don't we all kind of have that strange meter? Moms and dads, stranger danger, right? We all have that strange meter that past a certain point, there will be no meaningful interaction with the person if the meter goes too high. Am I right? But the thing about interacting with somebody, especially when they are different from us, especially when they're really different from us, whatever way that might manifest itself, is that the more that we meaningfully engage with other people, the more the strangeness diminishes. The more we begin to see the other person as person and not identify by whatever activity, whatever choices, whatever ethnicity, whatever it may be that separates us. Those things tend to begin to go away. You know, Jesus interacted with a lot of people and beings, did he not? I mean, from the very beginning, Lee, as he just described, there's some sort of interaction with angels, with shepherds, with men from the east. Early in life, We're told at 12 years old, to be specific, Jesus is interacting with the teachers at the temple. He's hanging out with adults. Jesus interacted with the religious elites, Pharisees, scribes, Sadducees, Herodians. We have precious little info on the Herodians, by the way, but we know there was interaction there. Synagogue leaders and other leaders of all sorts in that religious society. Jesus interacted with religious elites. Jesus interacted with marginalized people. And I've broken these down into categories, by the way, and this won't be an exhaustive list. I'm sure I forgot somebody, but know this, that every category that I list here falls under the larger category of social outcast. So Jesus interacted with the medically marginalized, lepers, which in Scripture, and if you have a study Bible, it probably tells you this more than once, leprosy was like a stand-in word for all manner of skin diseases, many of which were contagious. The lame, Jesus engaged and interacted with. The blind, the deaf, the mute. And at least one time that we know of, a woman who had some internal, we'll just say it that way, some internal issues. Jesus interacted with the mentally marginalized. Think about all the times someone was oppressed by a demon or many demons. And Jesus sat with them and spoke with them, interacted with them. Jesus interacted with the demographically and professionally marginalized in his society, very different from ours, by the way, for the most part. Women were demographically marginalized. Children were demographically marginalized. And then people like tax collectors and such, because of their profession, they were kept on the margins as much as possible. Jesus engaged with the ethnically marginalized. Samaritans, Gentiles of all stripes, right? Tyrians, Sidonians, certainly Romans as well. Jesus interacted with the religiously marginalized. The Samaritans again, the Gentiles again, those in his own faith, Judaism, that were classified as sinners, and really pretty much every other person that I've mentioned up to this point would have been marginalized religiously. You know, in the disciples, we really look up to those guys in the book of Acts, do we not? As an incredible example of courage and of faith and of evangelistic fervor and a willingness to suffer and even die for the cause of Jesus Christ. And so rightfully so, we go to that great book written by Luke, Acts, and we read that book and we go, wow, if I could only be like John, or if I could only be like Peter, or if I could only be like Paul. But if we go back to the previous four books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the disciples in those books also stand as an example, but it's rarely in the positive. The disciples had not yet in the Gospels developed the ability or the desire to interact with people the way that Jesus, their teacher, did. And just a few examples, you may know all of these, you may not. And again, it's not an exhaustive list, but think first of all about the feeding of the 5,000 men. So we have 5,000 men, a lot of women, a lot of children, so maybe 15, 20,000, even more people. Jesus and the disciples have crossed the lake. The people have followed apparently around the lake to find Jesus again. Jesus sees them coming, and you remember what Matthew's account says about Jesus. When he sees the crowd, he has compassion, which is something that rises up from within. He has compassion because he sees them as harassed and helpless. The disciples, on the other hand, prove very quickly that they don't see and look upon the crowd with compassion. I think they're looking upon the crowd with annoyance. Because they say what? Send them away. Send them away. Jesus and his disciples, you may know this story in Matthew 15 and Mark 7, the Canaanite woman, the Syrophoenician woman, they go up to the vicinity of Tyre and Sidon, which we understand to be hostile country. This is Gentile territory. The disciples do not want to be there. And this woman comes out crying out to Jesus because her daughter is oppressed by a demon. And what do the disciples say? It's only in one of those accounts, by the way. Send her away because she keeps crying out after us. In Luke's account and also in Mark's account, there's a moment where the disciples say to Jesus, and what's interesting about this moment, and I'll tell you about it in just a moment, is that it immediately follows Jesus' words to his disciples about the truth and the fact that they need to be servants and they need to receive others like he receives others. So it's right on the heels of this, literally. They say to Jesus that there was somebody casting out demons in his name. And quote, "We tried to stop him because he was not following us." In other words, he ain't part of our group, Lord. He's not in my clique. He wasn't like us. Maybe had never seen him before. Who knows? And of course, Jesus goes on to rebuke them and tell them anyone who's doing a mighty work in his name is for them and not against them. And then there's a story that follows right on the heels of that story, by the way, where James and John, and you probably know what's coming here, the Samaritans have rejected Jesus. They've gone to a town of the Samaritans, and the Samaritans did not receive him. In other words, we could say fairly, maybe they had a little bit of different beliefs, which they did, by the way. Actually had a different Bible, in a sense. They don't believe like we believe, and they're proving that by rejecting you. So famously, James and John say, "Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven to consume them?" And then a couple of the Gospels, and this is the last one I'll share before we read from Luke 7. A couple of the Gospels, we get this vignette where people are bringing children to Jesus for him to bless them. Now, one account says that the disciples rebuked the people, which would imply the parents, correct? I think it's Mark's account that says the disciples rebuked them. So it's hard to tell in that second account if it's the parents being rebuked, the whole group being rebuked by the disciples, or if it's actually the children who are being rebuked. But the point is, people are bringing their children to Jesus and the disciples are trying to turn them away. They don't want to interact with them. And so over and over we have these negative examples, instructive, but negative examples of the disciples not engaging with certain people because they're not like us, because they don't believe what we believe, maybe, because they're on the margins for a reason, because they're Gentiles and they annoy us, or because there's a big crowd and we don't want to be around them. We don't know who or what is in that crowd. Luke chapter 7, we're going to read the whole thing, by the way, because I like to get some context here. And watch as we go, and I'll try to point it out, watch as we go the different sorts of people that Jesus engages in these stories. After he had finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. If you read chapter 6, you'll see a lot of stuff that sounds familiar, Sermon on the Mount type of stuff. Now, a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death and who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, now what would a centurion be? the Roman and Gentile, right? When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent him to the elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. Or he sent to him elders of the Jews. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. When he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you," the implication that I did not presume to come to you myself, "but say the word and let my servant be healed, for I too am a man set under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it." When Jesus heard these things, he marveled at him, and turning to the crowd that followed him, said, "I tell you," crowd, who's in the crowd, by the way? Overwhelmingly what? If not exclusively Jews. "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the servant well. Soon afterward, he went to a town called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. As he drew near to the gate of the town, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother. And she was a widow, and a considerable crowd from the town was with her. So she's multiply marginalized, isn't she? She is a widowed female in the first century. And when the Lord saw her, she had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." Then he came up, and notice what he did. He touched the coffin. He touched the bier. And the bearer stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him to his mother. It's interesting to note something grammatically important in here. When Jesus uses that term, arise, it is an imperative. It's a command, but it's in the passive. And so what he's literally saying is, be raised. Letting everybody know that it's only through the power of God. This young man's doing nothing of his own accord. It is only through the power of God that this young man is raised. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report about him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. So Jesus interacting with Roman Gentiles. Jesus is touching coffins. Now we read a little bit about John the Baptist, and if you want to talk about somebody who was very different from most everybody else in his world, it was certainly John the Baptist. The disciples of John reported all these things to him, and John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to the Lord, saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And when the men had come to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another?" In that hour he healed many people of diseases and plagues and evil spirits, and on many who were blind he bestowed sight. And he answered them, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard." And here's our marginal list. The blind receive their sight. The lame walk. Lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead are raised up. The poor have good news preached to them. And blessed is the one who is not offended by me. When John's messengers had gone, Jesus began to speak to the crowds concerning John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing?" And don't miss the implications about the religious elite in here. by the way. Behold, those who are dressed in splendid clothing and live in luxury are in king's courts. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you. And more than a prophet. This is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way for you. I tell you, among those of women, none is greater. Among those born of women, none is greater than John. Yet the one who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he. When all the people heard this, and the tax collectors too, they declared God just, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected the purpose of God for themselves, not having been baptized by him. To what then shall I compare the people of this generation, and what are they like? They're like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to one another, We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge and you did not weep. For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say, he has a demon. He's strange. He's not like us. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, look at him, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Yet wisdom is justified by all her children. And I believe all of that sets up this next story, which is the one I really wanted to get to. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and reclined at table. And behold, a woman of the city, we know what that means, right? Okay, explain that to your children if you like, in your own words. A woman of the city who was a sinner, on top of that, when she learned that he was reclining at table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment. And standing behind him at his feet, remember Jesus is reclining, so if you can get that image, so she's behind him, but she's down by his feet. Weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair of her head and kissed his feet and anointed them with ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner. And Jesus answering said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. You think there's a big gulp moment right there for Simon? Kind of a uh-oh. And he answered, Say it, teacher. A certain moneylender had two debtors, Jesus goes on. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt. And Jesus said to him, You've judged rightly. Then, turning toward the woman, and I've pointed this out before, but this is such a powerful moment. Because Jesus turns to the woman, but speaks to Simon. Turning to the woman, he said to Simon, Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. And he said to her, Your sins are forgiven. Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." There's a whole lot in that story, but just a few things I want to point out, and we're almost done. You notice that the Pharisee did not truly see the woman. The only thing that the Pharisee saw was her past. The Pharisee saw a flawed history. He did not see a human being. But in contrast, Jesus truly saw her. And you notice the language, by the way, that Jesus uses when he turns to the woman and he speaks to Simon. He says, "Do you see this woman?" And I think in there is an accusation against Simon that, "Simon, you really haven't seen this woman. All you've ever seen is what she's done in her life that you know of. But you're not seeing this person." But Jesus truly saw her. Yes, he praised her kindness, but more importantly, Jesus Christ recognized both her humanity and her infinite value. The difference between the woman and Jesus did not matter. That is a profound lesson from Jesus. When we commit to interacting meaningfully with people, especially those who are unlike us, over time, that strangeness, it'll diminish. It'll subside because we will start to see one another, not as identifying each other by where we've been, what we've done, how we were raised, what we look at, but rather just looking into the eyes of someone who is a fellow human being made in the image of God.